That's Ramsey Lewis and the Ramsey Lewis Trio with Wade in the Water, the title track of his 1966 album. It was recorded live the previous year. Ramsey Lewis, of course, on piano, John Avant on trombone, Cleveland Eaton on bass, and the late Maurice White. Yes, Maurice White of Earth, Wind, and Fire on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and it is time to free your mind on Free Your Mind Friday. Of course, you know that this is where the thinking folk gather to trade in information, opinions, and ideas, and we kind of round out the week sharing our views of the week's insanities. And of course, if you think last night's Clinton-Sanders face-off was something, well, you ain't heard nothing yet, as they would say in Brooklyn. The sparks fly right here on Free Your Mind Friday. Of course, it's an open forum. It's unscripted. You drive the bus, as it were, and you take us where you want us to go with you. We hope, of course, that you have something profound to offer. And we'll see how people react to your point of view, whatever it is. 888-874-4888 gets us started. And we start in New York, where that wonderful debate was. I watched it. I forced myself. It was interesting. But again, very, very predictable from my point of view. Joel, you're on the air.
Hey, Utrice. How are you doing?
Hi. Good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm fine. So, the other day I looked at a YouTube version of Bill Clinton's recent confrontation with some Black Lives Matter protesters, in which he reiterated his talking points that he and Hillary had used in 1994, that the drug violence, the drug gang violence, so-called gang violence, was real. And that he and Hillary's, you know, interest was humanitarian, and that many blacks supported the crime bill, and that the growth in incarceration rates for people of color was an unintended consequence. Remember all of that?
Yes, we talked about it here on the program.
Yes, I know. But left unsaid was that the crime bill was but one part of Clinton's, you know, opportunistic dog whistle strategy, that the policies were, in fact, really tied to more than three centuries of racial repression in the United States, and that regardless of whether the Clintons fully thought through the implications, as they said they did, they were willing to gamble with the lives of millions of black and brown youth for political gain. And so I thought I would talk a little bit more about that today. And I was thinking about, you know, the way contemporary political rhetoric works by usually erecting walls between ideas and policies that might otherwise be plausibly related. So what I'm getting at is that basic ideas of security, such as, you know, freedom from violence for one's person, or freedom from violence for one's family and neighbors and community, is a basic human right. But it's also the kind of human right that has been most tightly circumscribed throughout American history. And I kept thinking about that during Clinton's diatribe, because the American narrative, as it's written by the dominant culture, has been, and you've talked about this a lot, has been of white America under attack from hostile indigenous peoples and from so-called inner-city criminals, whereas the overwhelming preponderance of actual violence has been committed against the indigenous population and kidnapped Africans held in slavery and their descendants. But there's no discussion of that. And the same disjointed history is true of American military adventures overseas, always undertaken in official explanations, you know, to benefit those that are being bombed and sanctioned and starved and imprisoned. And Clinton himself spent most of his two terms in office, if one remembers, bombing and sanctioning Iraq to contain the former CIA asset, Saddam Hussein. And, you know, Hussein continued to eat well and sleep comfortably at night. It was the Iraqis who were least able to defend themselves, who were bombed, starved, and from whom, you know, life-saving medicines and medical care were withheld. And we know that close to 500,000 innocent Iraqis, and mostly women and children, were killed by Mr. Clinton's bombs and sanctions. And I mention all of this, Utrice, because this context is necessary, because when Clinton chose to defend his and Hillary Clinton's omnibus crime bill and its social consequences, in which he framed it once again as a kind of domestic humanitarian intervention, the real truth, the localized truth that Clinton used to do so, the freedom from violence, is a basic right, and he kept going on about that. He kept going on about that, even though the communities subsequently targeted were targeted with repressive policing, racially biased drug laws, and mass incarceration. So all of that was removed from the broader context of what he was talking about. And alternatively, without a real racial theory of crime, why would so-called liberal Democrats choose police repression and creation of of a carceral state before first resolving the political and economic exclusion that these communities have been suffering from? I think that was kind of interesting. And if one looks a little bit at history, the Clinton spent most of his two terms using coded racist themes. That's what I'm getting at when I refer to dog whistle politics. And they used these themes to benefit politically by raising racial animosity and affecting policies of repression. In other words, Clinton's welfare reform was framed as ending welfare as we know it, and it followed directly from Ronald Reagan's racist caricature, of welfare queens living high on the public dime. And Hillary Clinton's super predators comment likewise had implied race and class that was tied to racist themes of black supermen all hopped up and impervious to pain, bullets, and normal human emotions. That was the coded message there. The fact that the overwhelming preponderance of American racial violence has been perpetrated against blacks and the indigenous population seems like a murderous flaw in the dominant culture, it's a complete reversal of factual history into misdirected views. So that's what was going on, I think, in Clinton's diatribe with those protesters the other day.
I don't know if you watched the so-called debate, the Dog and Pony Show last night, but Hillary Clinton was forced to return to the question of the 1994 crime bill. And she discussed it in the same way that Bill Clinton discussed it, as a kind of, now that I think about it, it might have gone a little too far. But it is, for all intents and purposes, it's a kind of academic question. And she says last night, the bill might have, I'm sorry that the bill hurt a lot of, and she paused, people, because she knows which people got hurt. disproportionately hurt by the crime bill. So even they had distanced themselves. It was one of those things. It's a policy matter. And, they have the luxury of looking back and seeing this devastating impact largely as a kind of a policy review.
Yeah.
Having no intention to basically admit responsibility for what in any civilized country would be considered a crime against humanity.
Well, that's because they're amoral to the bone. I saw a figure recently that stated that Americans are 35 times more likely to die from an accident at a doctor's office than they were in 1994 to die from gang violence. And the Clintons knew exactly what they were doing when they used coded racist appeals to peel away white suburban voters from national Republicans. And the strategy worked politically for them at that time. Never mind the body count of destroyed lives, that they left behind.
It still is working. Thanks for getting us started today, Joel. Always something to learn from you. Always. Thank you so much for contributing. Sure. Let's talk to Fidel of New York City. Hello, Fidel.
I'm calling you because yesterday I was left with a thought. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get on the show, but I believe the question or the premise of your show yesterday was to how do we move forward, given the political options that we have in front of us now? And I heard a lot of people calling in that have rightfully so, in all fairness to them, given up on this process. However, as I told your screener, I'm Cuban, and I sometimes wonder if these are the very same people that are all for change in Cuba in the form that it is coming now. So I also want to address the many issues that are facing the electorate. Not everybody.
All right, before you do, Fidel, I just want to say one thing. I do not screen calls.
Okay.
The person,
the
engineer, takes the name of the person's calling and just transmits them to me. I never ask, well, what do they want to say or what are they talking about, nor does he tell me what they want to talk about. So I do not screen calls at all. But
you're absolutely right, and I apologize for that lack of eloquence on my side. However, getting back to my point, there's a lot of issues. It's not one issue. There are a lot of issues that are plaguing the electorate right now. A lot of people are very tired, and when they come home, and they feel like they are engaged in the process and that they are paying attention because they turn on the TV and they get what the media is shaping their ideas. Because if you notice, the pundits, what they say is what you need to know. I'm going to tell you what you need to know. That's a common narrative that they preface their stories on. I don't want to blame the American electorate so much as I want to blame the media for their organized propaganda. The other thing is that oftentimes people wonder why specifically the older black vote is going for the Clintons, and they come up with all name recognition, et cetera, et cetera. I tend to look at it differently. I think that this is a demographic that has no access to real income, and thereby they are not as fortunate as some of us are to have computers and be as savvy on the computers as we are. And so, again, they rely on this propaganda media machine that we are all well aware of. So I just make circling back and wanting to make my point is that I think that the Bernie Sanders campaign has, if anything else, given all of us an opportunity to look critically at the issues that are in front of us, has given us a civic lesson, and his movement is starting to make people more aware, more enthused in the process, and putting the onus back on us, the voter, and how we need to engage our fellow citizens in so that we can together make better decisions and not constantly be voting against our own best interests. And I'm not saying that he's the golden bullet or the silver bullet, but we have to start somewhere, and I think that somewhere is right now. And I'm making an appeal to all the people that want to support Jill Stein, which is my choice of candidate as well. But unfortunately, at this point in history, does not stand a chance, because if Senator Sanders was not known throughout the country, imagine a Jill Stein. So
I have a question for you. I have a question for you. Now, I understand your position, and I think you're correct about the fact that this movement, this burgeoning movement under Sanders, does in fact devolve back to the people to do something with the energy being generated here. But are you not letting him off the hook as well when you say, well, he's doing his part, which is running, and we now have to do our part and make something of this movement? To what degree do you hold Bernie Sanders accountable for what he proposes to do with the vote. And he is very clear. As of yesterday, an interview with his wife kind of confirmed that, in which she said that Bernie is committed to supporting the Democratic nominee, quote, whoever it might be, unquote. Well, I mean, come on, it's just two of them in the race. And so it's a done deal in a sense. So do you have any questions about Bernie concerning this?
I do. Actually, truth be told, full disclosure, at the beginning of his running, my exact words was, he is going to deliver us to Hillary Clinton. Those were my exact words. However, as I have seen the evolution of this campaign, I can't negate the fact that the people are what is driving his campaign. And if his intention was to deliver us to Hillary Clinton, I think he bit off more than what he can chew at this point, because the people are not going to stand by it. I certainly will never, ever support her or any of the Republicans. And if that means writing a name or voting for Jill Stein, so be it. But I will never, in good conscience, again, vote for either one of them. And if he is proposing to do that to us, this is a hypothetical, but proposing that he is doing this to us, shame on him, and I think that the Democratic Party is going to have a big war on its hands. And I just think, again, that the people are what is driving his campaign at this point. He is not driving.
Well, you went off of the plantation, so to speak. You're not in the Democratic fold. You're going third party. What caused you to do that? What caused you to think of Jill Stein of the Green Party as a candidate you support, although today you're saying you identified so strongly with Bernie Sanders? What made you cast your lot with Stein?
Okay, I agree with the movement, much like Castro. You know, the revolution in Cuba was not about Castro. He overtook that revolution. There are many other players. Cienfuegos was one of the major players in that revolution that all of a sudden disappeared. And he was much more charismatic, much more liked by the people. But as history goes, Castro was the one that overtook because of his communist leanings. And he just strong-armed the revolution. So I'm saying that it is about the people at this point. It could have been initially him trying to deliver us to Clinton. But I think that the movement has overtaken that idea, and we're full throttle ahead. And I just hope that I'm right and that the people that are somewhat ambiguous are wrong, because it's all we've got at this point. And otherwise, I just feel that there will be hell to pay. People are very angry. And you can't deny that.
Well, thank you very much for your call today. Very informative. And I thank you for sharing it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
From Michigan, Leona, you're on the air. Hello, Leona, you there?
Hello. Yes. Can you hear me?
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Hello. Okay, good. I wanted to say hello to you and to your audience, and I had a couple things I want to talk about, if you don't mind. You had a show on Wednesday, I think it was, where you were sharing personal parts of your life and your loves and about your dad and stuff like that. I want to let you know that I really loved that show. That was so wonderful, I thought. I felt, I guess, more in love with you or something, you know?
Thank you so much for that. I appreciate
it. You're welcome. Sure thing. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is there's something going on in D.C. right now called Democracy Rising. It's been going on for the past 5 days or so. I've been checking out a little bit of the coverage on another radio show, live coverage, live stream. And today, Chris Hedges was on the mic, and he was talking about how today is Emancipation Day in D.C., the day they celebrate where Lincoln signed that Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes.
And Chris was started talking about, he started off talking about today being that day and how the enslaved Africans who built the Capitol were never compensated, nor their children or grandchildren never compensated, and how the United States was built on genocide and slavery. And all of a sudden, the stream had technical difficulty. The mic went flat.
It happens.
Yeah. I said, wow, look at this. So I just thought I'd share that with you, just an observation I made. It just went flat. And then it came on again. When it came on again, there was a dark-haired woman talking. Chris was no longer on the mic. The technical difficulty was all over.
Well,
problem solved.
Have you give us a view of what's happening in Michigan, the home of Flint and Badwater and the home of Detroit and the systematic emptying of a city?
Well, well, Jesse Jackson was in the headlines a couple days ago, him and the white mayor of Detroit. I didn't read the entire article, but it's something with my quote-unquote minority contractors. There's yesterday, or not yesterday, but a couple of days ago, there's some effort underway to round up movie makers or artists and stuff like that to quote-unquote change the narrative about Detroit. There's this Detroit Narrative Agency. I went to their meeting. It was a public forum. And evidently there's grant monies available to change the narrative about what's going down in Detroit. And who has say on the final narrative, I'm unclear. But it's Ford Foundation is funding it. There's still, recently there was a North American Social Solidarity Economic Forum going on in Detroit, a three-day thing. I popped in on some of it. I don't know if I'm hitting what you want to hear. I haven't
No, it's
been...
just it's interesting snippets from somebody who is there and can, you know, tell us or share with us what's concerning the majority of people in your community.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't feel qualified to speak for the majority of the folk, you know, because...
Okay. Fair,
yeah.
Fair.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Thank you so much for contributing today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Sure thing. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to North Carolina. Janice, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. And
thank you for calling.
I beg your pardon?
I said, thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, I tuned in a little late, and I heard you and Joel discussing the Clinton crime bill. And
yes.
You know what really I'm just horrified by the fact that while they're talking about this, up until recently, Hillary was taking money in this campaign cycle, was taking money from the prison-for-profit industry. And that is just, that gives me such a horrible reaction. It's just horrifying. It's just the height of hypocrisy and duplicity and just the hallmark of somebody who is totally untrustworthy. So I'm hoping, I agree with everything just about that Fidel said. Bernie is a chance to go in a different direction. And I'm a former New Yorker, and I am just so hopeful that New York rises to the occasion to stop the Clinton machine. And they really do have a chance. If Bernie can defeat Hillary in this New York primary, then I think we're going to see maybe good things happening from here on in. Not a guarantee, but it's a good possibility. It's just going to be kind of a showstopper for the Clintons. I don't know how they're going to be able to explain this one away. So I'm just so hopeful that New Yorkers do get out and cast a vote for Bernie. I did watch the debate last night, and one of the things I was really struck by was when Bernie spoke out on behalf of the Palestinians, which, as far as I know, historic in itself, because I don't believe any politician at that level has spoken so honestly about the situation with the United States always giving Israel a blank check that no matter what they do, it's okay. And somebody finally is speaking up and saying, you know what, it's not. We have to look at the suffering of the Palestinian people. And I just think he deserves a lot of accolade for being able to do that. So I think that in itself is something that should cause people to vote for him.
But, you know, I listened very carefully to his position, and on the two foreign policy issues that CNN raised, uh-huh. Israel and Libya, yeah. I found him to be wanting
okay.
on both. And in fact, taking great pains to show where just, I mean, more than anything else, he actually was in line with Hillary Clinton on these two things, but just cosmetically different. When, for example, Bernie Sanders made the objection about the inordinate impact of war by Israel against Palestinians in Gaza, he framed it as a humanitarian issue. And mm-hmm. that bothered me. In fact, it got me mad. This is not about humanitarianism. This is about people being dispossessed of their land. This is about people being killed off in order to get the land. This is about the original people being thrown out of their own country. And when he decides to frame it as a humanitarian issue, he also negates the ability of self-rule for Palestinians. He implies, as does Hillary, of course, they only differ cosmetically on this, that we ought to be kind to the Palestinians who have no way of helping themselves. Mm-hmm. These are the people who basically were our descendants of Palestine. And I think history would record that they have had thousands of years of expertise and experience in self-governance, and in fact opened Palestine for everybody. Everybody lived in Palestine. This bothered me a great deal. I'll be talking about that next week, where Bernie Sanders is giving some very troubling signals. He did not confront Hillary Clinton on Libya. In fact, he agreed. He agreed with her that, essentially, and he spoke of it in very diplomatic terms about regime change. They mean an assassination. This is not about regime change. This was not about regime change. This was about killing Muammar Gaddafi. And she was delighted to do so. The two issues that were raised, and it bothers me, I just don't understand it, except for the overwhelming impact of the AIPAC lobby group. Why, in the midst of a national discussion, if you're going to talk about foreign policy, it seems to me it ought to be larger than Israel. But it is always asked, what's your position on Israel? What, are you bade to ask these questions? What is the deal? Of all the foreign policy questions that need to be asked, and particularly to confront Ms. Clinton on her foreign policy history, what is the question about Israel? Why is Israel the only foreign policy question that the people at CNN believe is relevant to ask? It bothers me. So they're talking about Bernie and those very, very troubling signals that he sent there last night, in which essentially he was on the same page with Hillary Clinton, differing with her only on these two matters, differing only with her on not in a very substantive way. And I was expecting him to really confront her about her foreign policy history, which is just abysmal.
Can I respond?
Yes.
Hello? Okay. Well, about Israel and the Palestinians, I agree. It was, you know, I think in these kind of situations, being a politician, as he is, given the absolute corruption of the American media, but you kind of have to wade in gently to deprogram people. You know, the American people have been so brainwashed about America's policy with Israel, just giving them loads and loads of money to purchase weapons to use against the Palestinians, and that we should never question that, that I think if he went to the point which you said, which is all absolutely true and legitimate, that I think, frankly, it would just be counterproductive for him. I think you have to kind of go slow with people. And as for Libya, it was my impression, now I don't know the details, but it was my impression that the thing that he voted on was very different from what she did, or not what she did, but what President Obama ordered, which was the invasion of Libya, that he was not voting for that. But
The thing he faulted her for, and to some degree the Obama administration by extension, was that they didn't think it out well enough to take into consideration the aftermath, the immediate aftermath. Other than that, he had no problems with, quote, regime change in Libya. It was a startling position from my perspective. It was very startling that he would say something like that.
Well,
but he said it.
I don't, well, maybe I'd have to listen again, but I didn't really get the point that he didn't have a problem, but his criticism where he could really get her was to say, hey, you know, you had no thought about what were the consequences of this whole action. But I absolutely agree, yes, Hillary's foreign policy is terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying, which brings me back to my original point, you know, that she's got to be stopped. We cannot have her as president. And this is a way to do it, to vote for Bernie and hopefully give him the nomination. And I think he's somebody we could work with. You know, I don't think everything would be to say your liking or my liking overnight, but I think we could make real progress with him if we all get to work and do what we need to do.
Well, thank you for your call today, and thanks for contributing and being part of this discussion. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Matrice. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Let's go to Ali from New York. You're on the air, Ali.
Hi, Matrice. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. I wanted to say hello to all the listeners, and I just wanted to make a point about the debate. I actually didn't really listen to the debate, but the TV was so loud in my apartment that I didn't want to hear it, but I heard a few things. And one of the things that I heard was when they were talking about NATO, and one of the questions was about all that money that United States give NATO, so NATO could defend themselves and, you know, all these European countries and all that. And it struck me thinking that Hillary said that it doesn't matter if they can't afford, because United States, I mean, these are not her exact words, but it was to the extent like, even if they can't afford it, we're still going to give the money to those European countries because they are our allies. And it doesn't matter what happened, I'm going to be out there. And then she also brought Russia, and she was talking about, look what Russia is doing. And I was just thinking about that, because I'm thinking that she probably going to keep Samantha Power, Susan Rice, Victoria Nuland in her administration. I mean, these are women, they just think just like her. And if they think just like her, I think they're going to be part of her administration, because this woman is already thinking about Russia. And if she's thinking about Russia, and she's thinking about Ukraine and all these other countries, I think she wants this war. Or she wants to do something. That's why she's going to keep giving the money to NATO. And these are the three women, these feminists. I don't consider myself a feminist. I just wanted to tell you. I don't believe in that term. But these women, that they consider themselves feminists, is something wrong with them, a lot of them. Because I'm saying women in powerful positions like them, because they have to show something to the world that they're so powerful. And I just was thinking that when I heard Fidel saying that the people that they're voting for Bernie, I have a 25-year-old child in my household right now, and he's going to vote for Bernie. But I'm going to tell you one thing. One thing that he's telling me, that if Bernie doesn't win, he's not going out there to vote for Hillary. So I don't know, if you don't have something, how can you say that you're going to deliver? All these people that are going to vote for Bernie, how can Bernie think that he could deliver those people to Hillary? Like, it's just so easy that he's going to be trying to convince his people to vote for this woman. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to vote in the primary. I have to say this. I'm not voting on the general election. I'm not. I don't care even if it's Bernie wins. I'm not doing it. But I will go over there. From three people in my household, the three, we're going to go out there to vote for Bernie. But if Bernie thinks that people are going to go out and vote for this evil woman, it's has to stop, especially for what that just lady just said. How this woman talks about the people in prison, how the Bill Clinton administration signed that bill in 1994 to put all these people in prison, and now they trying to defend it, and she even making money out of the prison system. It's a sick thing if you take it overall. But my last thing that I wanted to say. You were talking about, a lot of people always call and say, get involved in politics, your local politics. In New York, it doesn't matter if you get involved in your local politics, you put people of color out there, they still don't do the job that we send them for. Look at all these people in New York City with this inclusionary, with the housing, the MIH, how they voted against their own people to get people out of New York City. So I don't know, what are we going to do? I think we have to rise up. That's what the only thing that we have to do. That is the only way that we could stop what's going on all around the world, to rise up. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. We had a little glitch there. I don't know what it is. The techno gods are after me, and I have to do something about this. This is not supposed to happen. But anyway, we proceed. Ed from Queens, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, yeah, Ed, afternoon. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Eutrice. How you doing? I watched that quote-unquote debate last night. I wasn't surprised, unfortunately. I mean, I've never thought that Bernie Sanders was a true socialist. At best, he's a slightly radical Democrat. But once again, you know, it's the status quo. It's these politicians playing the game that they are presented to play. And the only thing, in my opinion, the only thing that's going to change any type of outcome is when the common people start to take control of the mechanisms of this government. and eventually, over a period of time, destroy it and replace it with something better. That's the only way. And it's going to have to be on a local level. It's going to have to start in your neighborhood, in your district, in your borough, in your community. You're going to have to, people are going to have to take an interest, get politically educated, like the days of Omawale Clay and Samori Marksman. They're going to have to get educated. They're going to have to get liberated. And they're going to have to take charge of the situation. That's the only way I can see. Only way I can see.
So you see this pretty much as a done deal. You see Sanders capitulating to Clinton, and basically it's a write-off for you?
Pretty much. I mean, I don't see him using the movement that he created with and the enthusiasm that he created to make any marketable difference. He's a machine politician for all of the good talk that he's making, and that debate showed it. They basically didn't have any fundamental differences. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there were some things that there was a fundamental difference, but it was basically a dog and pony show, you know? I mean, with Palestine, the statements that he made about that, the fact that he never confronted her on Libya, which was a crime and an atrocity, the incarceration bill, the decimation that her and her husband did to welfare reform. I mean, come on, you know, if you're not going to confront her and hold her accountable on that, then, you know, what are you saying? What are you doing?
I agree with you. I agree with you 100% on these points. So we'll be talking about that next week a little bit, too. Thanks so much for calling, Ed. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Eutrice. How are you today?
Hello, wonderful Harvey. How are you doing?
Great. Well, I'd like to talk about something in another direction. I'd like to talk about the possibility that we humans are multidimensional beings. And when we're awake, we exist in a three-dimensional world, length, width, and depth. And at the same time, the arrow of time moves in one direction, from the past to the present and from the present to the future. So we're multidimensional beings moving forward through time and space. But it's my belief that we really are we're three-dimensional beings moving forward through time and space, but it's my belief that we're really multidimensional beings and that our brain has the ability to transport us to other timelines and other universes. And if you think of railroad tracks, two metal tracks that run parallel to each other and are connected by railroad ties that are at right angles to the tracks, like these railroad tracks, when we're awake, we're running down one time track from the past to the future, but when we go to sleep at night, we enter into the trance state between waking reality and the dream time, and our multidimensional brain has the ability to, figuratively speaking, move at right angles and switch tracks to a parallel timeline, a parallel universe that's not bound by length, width, and depth or the regular direction of time. In a sense, we're free to wander the hills and valleys of our dreamtime landscape. And our scientists tell us that according to current mathematics, there are at least 11 parallel dimensions. But my feeling is just as there are an infinite number of stars in the sky, so there's an infinite number of dimensions that we can access when we transition to the dreamtime. And in the quantum world, in the world of quantum physics, which is a study of the smallest particles in the universe, like electrons and photons of light, there's a strange phenomenon known as superposition, which states that an electron can be in two places at the same time. And so since we are composed of electrons as well as protons and neutrons, I believe that we have the ability to be both asleep in our bed and awake in the dream time at the same time. And some dreams seem so real that it's a shock when we wake up. And a lot of people, when woken suddenly, say things like, I'm not all here yet, because they haven't completed the transition back from the dream time. And it's my feeling that we truly are multidimensional beings with one foot in the physical and the other foot in the metaphysical. I just want to say all my love to you and your fantastic audience. Thank you, you wonderful Eutrice.
oh boy, I am experiencing difficulty after difficulty. I'm in the boonies and the signal isn't very, very strong and it fluctuates. I wish, Harvey, I could be in the two worlds at the same time, and the one that actually works and not the one that is fouling up all the time. But anyway, we proceed, and thanks so much for your patience. Charlie from New York, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. I am calling.
Thank you.
I just have a quick statement. Regarding the, you know, Israel and Libya and the Palestinians, particularly Israel and the Palestinians, any politician that begins their campaign saying that they are completely going to back the Palestinians and look into war crimes against Israel, they're dead on the spot. They're dead on arrival. No one will cover it. No one will support them because it's just an absolute taboo. That's just my point.
Okay, but why?
Why? Because it was brought up earlier that the media, you know, when people come home from work, they're tired. They turn on whether it's CNN, MSNBC, or their local affiliate, and they get information. Well, who controls that information? It is. It's all propagandized. It's all, you know, consumerism. You know, live a happy, healthy, prosperous life, and this is how you do it, by going out and the latest machines and computers and things and whatnot. And if anyone is going to go against that, the media won't cover you. They will crucify you immediately. Israel has, AIPAC has such a strong control on our government. They have a strong control of our media, which, and our politicians, all of our federal politicians have to pledge an oath to Israel when they're elected. So it's just, Israel is in a strong stranglehold of our nation on multi-levels, and to go after Israel is going to be, you know, it'll be death to that person. So I think that if we were to at least get Bernie Sanders in, he's someone that could be moved, you know, but with demonstrations. He would listen, and he would push people to make better choices for Palestine.
Well, let me ask you this. If Bernie Sanders were to get the nomination, and even, let's project that he gets the presidency.
Okay.
What chance do you think he would have? Barack Obama, who is certainly a moderate, if there ever was one, he played ball with the Congress and so forth, and they still utterly rejected him. What chance do you think Bernie Sanders would have with a Congress, given what you just stated as the premise that we are operating on, and that is that he doesn't stand a chance of getting where he wants to go in terms of foreign policy changes?
I think Bernie Sanders is the very person, is someone that will definitely call people out. I think that, because he has no problem doing it now, he will call people out on their discretions and, I guess, transgressions. It's very telling to me when he starts talking about Hillary Clinton and really pushing her on the Wall Street issue. I wish he would have done more on the Libya thing last night, but I feel that he will definitely start calling out congressional members, saying this person has taken X amount of dollars. This person will not vote for universal health care or free tuition, free college because of. I feel that. I could be wrong. I hope not, but I want to have hope in something, because if we continually go down this road of, well, we can't do it, we can't do it, we can't do it, then we're going to be we all just may as well just go to work every day and not listen to the radio or just listen to classical music and not pay attention anymore.
All right, let me ask you to kind of look at this scenario for a minute. Suppose Bernie Sanders does not get the nomination. What do you think he's going to be doing with all these votes?
What is he going to be doing with all of these votes?
Oh, what should he be doing, I should say?
My personal opinion is he should then, if he's not the Democratic nominee, he should run as an independent. And the vote will be split. Of course, we know that. But that's why Hillary Clinton is so terrified, and she continues to reiterate, we need to unify the party, because she knows that if she does not get the Bernie Sanders supporters, she will lose. She knows that. And she's very scared. So I just think that if Bernie Sanders doesn't get the nomination, in my opinion, he runs as an independent. And because there are a lot of independents in this nation and a lot of Democrats that will follow him and vote for him as an independent.
Well, let's see. But thank you for putting that scenario out for consideration today. Thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of our program. I thank you all for contributing. I thank you for contributing at such a consistently high level. And I urge you over the weekend to just get to know your family and friends a little bit better. Hang out with people who bring positive dimension to your life. Absolutely reject people who do not. Just don't get close to them. They are really going to shorten your lifespan. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You can reach me at leadstories, LEID stories @gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other on Monday. And thank you for putting up with these little glitches today. We should have it all solved by Monday. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.